case for this morning, United States v. Beaver.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Chris Choate, and I represent Chris Beaver, the appellant in this case. I have three main points to discuss today. The first is that the false statements were not material as a matter of law, and that his subsequent remedial measures do not make them material. The second point is that there was no conspiracy as to Mr. Beaver proven to support a conviction under the Sherman Antitrust Act. And finally, that there was insufficient evidence to support a conviction under the Sherman Antitrust Act. Turning to the false statements, the false statements were not material as a matter of law because they were incapable of influencing the investigation. Yes, this was a federal investigation. Yes, when he told the investigators that he was not at the October 2003 horse barn meeting, that was a false statement. However, they were incapable of affecting the investigation. This is because of two reasons. The first reason is because, as the FBI agent testified on the stand, a difference of 3 or 4 days did not matter. And that relates to his subsequent remedial measure, which was 24 hours later, Mr. Sheeks, who was counsel for Mr. Beaver, contacted the FBI in Chicago and told them that that his clients had not been truthful with the FBI.
But you really don't have any Supreme Court or Seventh Circuit authority, do you, that suggests that his correction of his false statements should prevent his conviction on a false statements charge?
It's acknowledged that there is no Seventh Circuit or Supreme Court authority for this. I'm relying on analogous cases such as the sentencing guidelines under 2B1.1, where the loss amount is reduced by the amount of the person who returns that money or makes, you know, amends before it is detected. Most relying on a Ninth Circuit case that is unpublished, where they tried a similar argument. It was unavailing, but that was because the defendant did that only after being told that the FBI already knew that he had lied.
Right, but those are big, big differences, aren't they, than our situation?
It's true that this is a novel interpretation. I'm just...
Well, it's a huge difference. It's like, stealing money from a bank and then the next day bringing half of it back, or bringing all of it back. The crime is committed when you steal the money. So when the statement is made, that's if it's a crime, that's when the crime is committed. The fact that you recant later on, and I admit it here, it's fairly close in time, but that...
In this situation, however, when he recanted, he actually brought the searchlight back on himself. As the United States notes, they actually thought that Gary Beaver was the person present at the horse barn meeting. Had Chris Beaver just gone about his business and never told them that he was actually there, maybe they never would have indicted him. But he actually took affirmative steps to bring the spotlight back on himself, so in a way he was actually assisting the investigation.
Of course, it's interesting. What's happened to the other? Is it Ricky Beaver?
Ricky Beaver.
There's no appeal from him, is there?
I do not know, Your Honor. We were contacted by Chris Beaver and hired
this
by...
This is his cousin, right?
Billy Brother.
Is his brother?
I believe so. I could be mistaken. I focused on Chris. but this actually brought the attention back on him, as opposed to impacting the investigation, which is what the whole false statements law is designed for, is to keep people from impacting investigations. This actually assisted their investigation by letting them know that what he said, for whatever reason, maybe he was nervous. It was very early in the morning, but for whatever reason, he told them a false statement. He tried to rectify that, and it actually ended up assisting the United States because they were able to bring charges against him. Moving on to the conspiracy.
Although there were government witnesses who testified that he was there, so even if he had persisted in his lie, there were witnesses who claimed he was there.
But that is true, that there were witnesses that pointed them to him. However, he did assist the government in his own, you know, prosecution, as bizarre sort of that sounds. Moving on to the conspiracy under the Sherman Act, while the other people who were prosecuted for this clearly thought that they were part of a conspiracy, there was nothing that was shown to prove that Mr. Beaver was actually part of this conspiracy. All that was shown was a bunch of assumptions on the other members. There were no overt acts. There were no oral agreements. And assumptions, I assumed last week that a prosecutor in Missoula, Montana was going to go along with me, and he didn't. That was my mistake, but that didn't, well, I thought we had an agreement, but we didn't have an agreement. And likewise, when the FBI comes and says to somebody, you know, if you talk with us and, you know, you agree to help us out, we're going to make sure that you get off. They can lie to you, but you can't lie to them. If we go with the government's argument, which was that if an agreement is an agreement, even if you never stick to it, that can lead to a lot of problems.
He did admit he attended the October 2003 meeting in the Horace Barn, right?
That is correct. But mere presence does not signal an actual agreement.
Yeah, but go ahead, Mike.
I was going to say, most of the witnesses say that agreement existed.
That's fine.
As a result of that.
They thought that there was agreement. But to join a conspiracy, there has to be a meeting of the minds. It's just like when you try to sue someone on an oral contract. Basically, you don't get past the front door because for legal purposes, there's no agreement.
Yeah, but when you combine that also with the fact that he lied to the FBI and about the meeting and the jury heard that, I mean, if he was innocent, why would he lie about the meeting? The combination of him saying, yes, I was there, the witnesses saying he was a member, he was active, he understood the agreement, and the fact that he lied, isn't that enough?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. What if he was nervous about being there in the first place?
Well, was an alternative theory argued?
By Alan Beaver. Alan Beaver testified that Chris Beaver was sent to find out what was being discussed. The government states in the reply.
But I mean, in terms of the jury, I mean, didn't Chris Beaver's counsel argue some different interpretation of the evidence to the jury?
I believe that generally, I think that what he argued, because Chris Beaver never took the stand, but I believe what was argued in closing was that there are all sorts of reasons to be present at a meeting. There was
right.
also official trade meeting, you know, trade
exactly.
group
so what
meetings.
I'm saying is that alternative theory of why he would be present at the meeting was before the jury. The jury rejected that. So, you know, it's not like those arguments weren't made. So it was a call by the jury.
That's true, Your Honor. However, I mean, I know that, you know, it would be nice to have something on the record to show that the jury clearly misunderstood things, but juries do misunderstand things, and they do get things wrong.
Didn't he have a phone conversation with a Scott Huey?
According only to Scott Huey. And Scott Huey's testimony was also different than many of the other.
Yeah, but that was certainly evidence, right?
It was evidence. It was put on the stand. Alan Beaver testified that no one was involved in a price-fixing conspiracy. That was evidence that was put on the stand. Just because Scott Huey said it.
Conflicting evidence.
Yes, Your Honor. But so just because Scott Huey says something does not necessarily make it so. Furthermore, the other co-conspirators and, you know, as among those four, none of them could remember anybody saying anything. And in fact, one of the other people said that it was someone else who was going to be making a phone call. It would be nice if there was something more. There were no overt acts. The only evidence of any pricing was when it was undercut. There were no oral agreements. No one ever said that they stood up and agreed. True, no one ever stood up and said that they don't agree. But just mere presence, and this is really what this is about. This is mere presence of a person with four people saying that they assumed that someone was there, apparently is enough to put someone in prison, which is kind of a weird result, especially when you look at other factors of the Sherman Antitrust Act, when if you're trying to sue someone for antitrust behavior, you have to prove an overt act to get past the threshold. It is recognized that Congress has not changed it, and they've had this law for many, many years. However, this is a case where a bunch of people say one thing, it's not proven that anything beyond that happened, and someone is in jail. And I understand what the law states, and I understand that Shabani stands for you don't have to prove an overt act. However, in those cases where that, you know, it's sort of the bad cases make bad law. In those cases where they argued no one ever proved an overt act, there were plenty of overt acts. People were selling drugs or, you know, conspiring to commit wire fraud, and there was overt acts to assist that. In this case, there were no overt acts. And, in fact, in other circuits, cases with far more proof of overt acts, those were in other sorts of conspiracy cases, those were overturned because of lack of evidence. So in this case, it is argued that the false statements were not material as a matter of law, that there were no that there was insufficient evidence to support a guilty verdict in this case, as well as that there was no proof that Mr. Beaver actually joined the conspiracy, because joining a conspiracy requires a meeting of the minds, and all that we have to show a meeting of the minds was other people's assumptions about his mens rea. If there's any other questions, I'll retain the rest for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Mintz.
May it please the court, I'm Stephen Mintz for the United States. I'd like to first address the issue of whether the evidence was sufficient for the jury to link Chris Beaver to the pre-existing conspiracy. In our view, as you know from the briefs, this is not a mere presence case. Your Honor just noted in the preceding argument that Mr. Huey testified that after the agreement that Chris Beaver attended, he had one or more telephone conversations with Chris Beaver in which he asked him, are you abiding by the agreement, or have you left it? And Chris Beaver responded, yes, we're abiding by the agreement. We have not deviated. That goes well beyond mere presence. It's confirmatory evidence that Chris Beaver had joined the conspiracy. There's other evidence to that effect. In addition to having just being present at the meeting for the full course of the meeting, all of the other government witnesses testified that Chris Beaver was a participant in the meeting. We don't know his specific words, but all of them testified that they believed they had reached an agreement and that Chris Beaver was included in that agreement. He wasn't a holdout. He wasn't disagreeing. He didn't have a different view. Also, both Huey and Price Irving testified to being told that Chris Beaver was at the meeting specifically because Ricky Beaver, his cousin, not his brother, actually, they were first cousins, Your Honor, that because Ricky Beaver had made
mistakes. I said he was a cousin.
Yes.
And I said he was a brother.
Yes, they were first cousins.
I know this family as well. So.
Ricky Beaver had made mistakes in carrying out the agreement, and so two of the witnesses testified to being told that Chris Beaver was there so that the agreement would be implemented properly. I mean, we think that that goes well beyond a mere presence case and is sufficient for the jury to have linked Chris Beaver to the agreement. Whether there was an agreement at all was a classic question for the jury. I mean, all of the government witnesses testified that they believed an agreement was made repeatedly at a sequence of meetings, including the one that Chris Beaver attended. They all believed that Chris Beaver and his company were participants in that agreement. There was some cross-examination that arguably shook some of those witnesses a little bit, but that means it's a jury question, and the jury decided in its discretion to believe the government witnesses and convict Chris Beaver. Under the Sherman Act, no overt acts are required. The violation of the Sherman Act is the act of agreement, and opposing counsel's brief concedes as much, so I don't feel that that requires more argument. I'd like to now turn to the materiality of the false statement question. In our view, that issue is waived. But even if it wasn't waived, we think the law is clear that the materiality of a false statement is judged at the time the statement is uttered, not whether the statement had any actual effect on the government or any other government agency or the prosecution.
So your position is that even if the false statement, because you would agree that the false statement didn't actually lead the government down the wrong track.
Well, you know, it certainly gave the government pause because other witnesses had said, there were a bunch of witnesses who were all interviewed on the same day, Your Honor, and other witnesses said, oh, yes, you know, the Chris Beaver and other Beavers participated in these meetings. Now, all of a sudden, Chris Beaver lies to the FBI and says, I wasn't there and I don't know anybody else who was. Well, you know, that kind of, all of a sudden, now the government's not quite sure what to do, and there's conflicting evidence. So I'm not ready to concede that it had no effect on the investigation. But the law says that the materiality is to be judged at the time the statement is uttered. And at the time that it was uttered, you know, it was certainly capable of diverting the government's interest away from Chris Beaver, away from his company. And that's a material thing. The jury was not going beyond its discretion in finding that could be material. I'd also like to point out that the correction or the retraction made by The company lawyer, Mr. Sheeks, in this case, was very tactical and very limited and really not truthful in several respects. If you look at Government Exhibit 45, that's the letter that Mr. Sheeks sent to the Department of Justice in which he said, oh, one of my clients made a misstatement. Well, Mr. Sheeks conceded on cross-examination that in that letter, he didn't identify which Beaver made the false statement. He didn't say whether it was Chris Beaver. He didn't say whether it was Ricky Beaver. He didn't say whether it was Alan Beaver or anyone else. He also didn't say that both Chris Beaver and Ricky Beaver had made false statements to the FBI. He didn't identify when the meeting took place, and he didn't say who else was present at the meeting. So it was an extremely limited and tactical disclosure that was made only after the defense knew that Alan Beaver, Chris Beaver's father, had basically given away the store by already telling the government in his interview that, yes, my son Chris Beaver was at the meeting. So, you know, it came under circumstances that, cast doubt on the willingness of the defense side to actually assist the government in the investigation as opposed to simply, reducing their own culpability. Unless the court has any further questions, we'll rest on our brief.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I just have one, counsel. Love the font of your brief. What type and font did you use? Because it was so clear and so easy to read.
It's one of the ones that's recommended in the Seventh Circuit Attorney Guide.
Right.
It's one of the book fonts. I don't think it's Bookman. I think it's either, it's not Arial.
It looks like
I'm sorry,
Arial.
But it's one of the ones that you recommend.
All right, thanks.
Bigger, though.
Yeah, it is bigger. It is bigger. It was so easy to read. I love this font.
Thank you.
Your font, on the other hand, is...
Well, I, too, tried to... I believe it might be Century. That's on the Seventh Circuit. Mm-hmm. Might be a Century. I just have one clarification. The government states that the letter and the phone calls to the FBI were done only after the defense knew that Alan Beaver had supposedly sold the house on them. This is sort of similar to the misstatement in the reply brief or the response brief where they say that Alan Beaver sent Chris Beaver because he thought that they were in a price fixing. That's not what was said. What was said when Alan Beaver took the stand, was that he thought that Ricky was talking to people, and there was no reason to do that, and there's many reasons not to do that. So what was just said now is that was not actually said on the stand. Mr. Sheeks did not state that it was only after finding out that Alan Beaver sold the farm on them that he contacted, and while Alan Beaver did testify on the stand that he told the FBI September 24th or whatever it was that Chris was at that horse barn meeting, it was not ever shown at trial that Mr. Sheeks found out from Alan that he had said that. So I just wanted to clarify the record for a little bit. Any other questions?
Lisa, thank you very much.